Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is bassist, songwriter, and producer Leo Lyons. Lyons is a founding member of the band 10 Years After. Earlier this year, Chrysalis Records released a reissue of the group's 1969 album, Shush, which was first released in the United States roughly 1 month after the group's legendary performance at Woodstock. The new 3-CD version features the original album in its original mix, a disc with a brand new 2025 mix, as well as a previously unreleased 1969 concert from Helsinki, Finland. The double LP version features the new mix and the Helsinki set. Lyons discusses the original album, the reissue, his career as a producer and songwriter, and much more on this episode of Into Music, coming up now. I'm happy to be talking to you about this reissue, and I wanted to kind of step back for a second because the previous record, Stonehenge, was, I guess, as one might say, kind of bonkers. it was a real kind of eclectic and studio driven kind of recording. So
I think it was a little pretentious, in my opinion. I think. A little indulgent. Best to listen to Stoned. You know, all those reasons, all those things. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, I'm just curious about how that was received, coming off, you know, 10 years after it sort of established itself as one kind of band, and then we get this record that's just, you know, out there.
Yes. Yeah. From what I can remember, there were a couple of tracks that may have been in the previous groove, but there were some weird things. I guess it was the psychedelic period, and I don't know. We didn't have a producer. I mean, the guy Mike Vernon that produced the second album was a live record anyway, but the first album. He was starting the Blue Horizon record label, so Mike was away a lot of the time, and we were just left to our own devices.
So that was the thing, was because, like, then we come to this record, and it's like, there's a little bit of that. There's, like, some stuff where I'm like, I think the guys had probably a lysergic experience or something, but it's more straightforward.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's done on 8-track. We got away from the restrictions of an established recording studio like Decca Records, where you start at 10 and there'd be a tea break at 11:30 where a lady came around with a tea urn. Then you had to stop for lunch. Then you'd have 3 hours in the afternoon, and then that would be it. And the next day you'd go and carry on and continue. So this time we were recorded on an 8-track. That was all 4-track. And we were... Our management had got a production deal in between the label and us. So basically we could pretty much do whatever we wanted on the Shush record. And we had a couple of good engineers in Andy Johns, who's Glenn's younger brother, and Roy Baker, R.T. Baker. Roy actually worked on some other records for us too. And he did record some of that, some of the Shush, along with Andy Johns. And Roy, of course, went on to produce Queen. I think a couple of Queen records, if not three of them. But so we had a couple of young guys that were into, doing something a little different. And...
Yeah, no, and that's one of the things that I love, is because it's like, it's not, it's sort of like, there are times where it's like, kind of like you go into a blues, but it's like this imagining of what the blues is like rather than like a strict rendition of a blues tune, right?
Yeah, it's a feeling, you know, rather than a strict thing of trying to emulate some guy that's been picking cotton in the Mississippi Delta. I've driven there, but I've never picked cotton there, and I've never tried to emulate that kind of thing. So it's a feeling. Everybody gets the blues, you know, and that was the kind of thing. It was our influences, blues, rock and roll. I think Muddy Waters and Sonny Terry Brown and McGee, a little bit of country here and there, you know. Every record, I think, was slightly different, you know, with 10 years after. It never went in a particular groove. I think our live shows were more representative of the, you know, the way the live shows developed was, it was more, you know, you want rock and roll in your face, here you go kind of audience that we played to. But we're always trying Space and Time. Again, a lot of reflective, having taken a year off, all border houses in the country, you know, more relaxed. If we'd have gone and lived in New York City, then we would have been more edgy. I guess it reflected how we felt at the time.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. But also, since we were talking about the, you know, the recording on 8-track, one of the other things that I'm aware of listening to this album, even the, you know, the 2025 remix, is that somehow I still feel like there's space and differentiation between the instruments. I think some of those records that came out in the late 60s, sometimes they were just kind of every nook and cranny was getting filled. And I feel like with this album, there's, at times I feel like I'm in the room, you know, and I can hear the air.
I agree with you. And with the remix has helped that, you know, it's getting, you know, there are more things you can do now. So there's more spatial awareness. You feel like you're in the room, as you say, rather than just listening. So left to right, a wall of sound like a jigsaw puzzle. Boom, it's all there. And you know, that's even more noticeable nowadays in the majority of music, recorded music. It's every hole's filled and it's like wallpaper. There's not room even for a virtuoso player, is there now? It's all very, very much all mixed together. So yeah, that was it. And we wanted to get the excitement that we felt we could get on stage, but in a different environment, which is a tough one. It's tough to do. I mean, I've produced lots of records since then, and it's always tough to do that. And particularly, you know, a lot of musicians, not all, because I've worked with some guys in Nashville that will do it in one take, one run through, one take, out on the record, but I mean, a lot of musicians will do it and it sounds great. And then they think, I could do that solo better and drop this and drop that in. And you end up with a track keeping a good drum track and everybody does their part again. So we try to play together. That's what we try to do, because that's the important atmosphere. And that little bit of spillover of a bit of keyboard or a bit of bass or whatever onto the drums, all goes towards the ambience of the music, rather than being isolated, everything isolated, and then putting reverbs in to try and tie it all in. So that's what we were trying to do. That's what I tried to do all my life.
Well, I wondered, because of your production career, by the time that you're making this record, were you already kind of interested in production, and were you paying attention to what was going on in the studio? And
yeah, I've been interested in production long before we had a record deal. I think I'd tape record a reel to reel and that kind of thing. Then I started doing demos for people. So I was very much into recording. By the time we got to there, my equipment had gotten better. I got a good stereo system, and I believe that it was around about the time I had somebody build a little recording console for me. So had a little home studio. I mean, subsequently, I've managed a big studio in London, actually, where Queen recorded some of their stuff. So I remember work with Roy there as well. But I had a couple of studios at home, commercial studios, I mean. And then I moved to Nashville, and I didn't really need a studio. There were so many around that I've always felt comfortable in the studio. It's something I enjoy doing.
At that time, when you start making records, are we still in kind of the period of, like, maybe you have engineers like measuring the distance between like the mics and the drums and things like that, really getting scientific about it? Or are they feeling more experimental, like, what if we place the mic too close or something, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of experimentation going on. I mean, the BBC recorded, you know, if you look at the BBC, which is the benchmark for a lot of recording studios in the UK, they were very, very careful not to oversaturate the tape, not to distort the microphone. And there was when I first started recording, particularly at Decca and EMI, I mean, the engineers wore brown coats, brown overalls. And you weren't allowed to go into the control room. So there was, this is the mic you use on the bass drum, this is how far it has to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But by this time, you've got a lot of young engineers coming in thinking, how did the Americans get that sound? Well, sloppy. You know, let's just try it, you know. You look at the Sun recordings and things like that, and a lot of the great records that came out of America at the time, They took a chance. They threw all that science out the window and let's stick the microphone right up to the front skin on the bass drum and see what happens. Or let's distort this or that. Let's over bias the tape. Let's saturate it and see what it sounds like. And it all came together. With Decca Studios and a lot of the major studios in the UK at the time, they were used to recording classical music. It had to be pristine. It had to be perfect. And so that kind of thing was starting to happen. And we started to have the budget to do that, although we didn't really spend that much time in the studio on any of the records compared with our contemporaries. I remember doing an interview and saying, oh, we spent, I don't know what the record was. It may have been Space and Time, I'm not sure. We spent 15 days in the studio, which, you know, normally we'd be 10 days and out. And that included the Indian takeaways, you know, it's not just 9 to 5 or 2 till 3 in the morning usually. But it was an interesting time. Things were changing. 4-track to 8-track. I started when it was 3-track, but it became 4-track. Actually, I started when it was stereo to bouncing from 2 stereo machines, working with a record producer called Joe Meek. I don't know whether you've heard of him in America.
Oh, yeah.
Telstar and that kind of thing. That was the first time I went in a recording studio, worked in a recording studio. So gone through the whole thing, 8-track to 16-track, 16-track to 24-track, 24-track machines linked together to 48-track, and then bouncing and bouncing, and then the whole digital thing came in. And how many tracks do you want? Oh, I'll do 90, you know. The whole business has changed, you know. But my ideal thing is to go in with a band, rehearse a few days, know what you're doing, and go in the band and knock the whole thing out in a matter of hours, you know. Maybe do the vocal again. If the guitar player's playing guitar, he wants to get his guitar right and his vocal right. So it's difficult to do the two at once, depending on the music you're playing. And that's it, the excitement for me. Just, you know, recording stuff. There's so many options now on recording and so many, what are they called? Presets. You know, a lot of young engineers are now brought up on presets. You press a thing and it gives you such and such a sound or such and such a sound. And I work subsequently because I engineered and I produced, and then I just produced set the EQ on the kit before anybody's ever hit a skin. You know, this is what I normally use. This is so it's a strange. There are some great sounding records, don't get me wrong, but it's very different to that flying by the seat of your pants and getting that thrill when something comes together in the studio, when the whole band click, you know, and the atmosphere's there, and you think, wow, that is a great vocal. You know, so it's all changed. And it's a lot of work, you know, when you've got 27 options, you can record a drum kit and then you can resample it and change the sound of the snare or the bass drum, and then the bass guitar doesn't fit with the track because it's a different sound. you change that, and then the guitar doesn't fit, and all of a sudden you can polish the soul out of something now. So I don't produce as much as I turned down a lot of work, because I think now I don't want to do it. It's a stressful job.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. I want to ask you specifically about your bass playing and your bass playing on "Good Morning, Little Schoolgirl," because it's incredible. And
that's very kind of you to say. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah. Well, and this is also right. Like, there was this thing I've been told that, you know, in the 60s, they were always concerned about too much bass on a record. It's going to make the needle jump and stuff like that.
That's correct. Yeah, you had to keep the grooves narrow.
And here you are just like all over the place on the neck. And it's like, I can hear the bass on this album. This is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time I use the higher register too, you know, it's which I think helped. But there was always the worry about the more the groove jumps, the lower the level has to be, and everybody wanted a louder record. And one thing or another. Now you can do it to a certain extent. You can do it now, and now, of course, with the digital thing sounding so clean and clinical, we're now putting it back through tape machines to get that, you know, the cymbals to sound a little bit weird, and the whole thing to lock it all together. But yeah. There were limitations, particularly on vinyl. Of course, that was the big problem. And you know, you'd record the record in the studio, and you listen back to the stereo, and it was on the big speakers, and it was what you recorded it onto. And yeah, that's fantastic. And then it goes to the cutting plant, and you go and cut it. And then the test pressing comes back, and you listen to the test pressing, and that's distorted, and oh, they've changed that, and, you know. It was a nightmare, particularly when I was producing, because I had to give the record release date is looming, and you've got the test pressing, and it's not what you want, and they wanted, okay, go. And yeah, it was a strange thing. I had test pressings back where I'm sure the pressing engineer was eating his lunch, because it sounded like there were crumbs all over it. It's weird. So weird.
Well, one of the other things I wanted to say too about that's evident in this music on this album, and I think throughout the recorded output of 10 years after, is that you also, as a band, didn't lose your Englishness. There's still this like sense of humor and way of playing things. And you kind of alluded to this before, you know, I didn't grow up picking cotton in the Mississippi Delta. You were like, hey, we're an English band that just happens to borrow some of these, you know, American idioms and so forth.
I think a lot of, not all bands, but a lot of the American bands were so relaxed on dope and other things that they just went out on stage and they just played through the thing and that was it. And they were great players and the songs were good, but they didn't put that energy in. With 10 years after, we were out there. We wanted to get a reaction from the audience. You know, bands like Zeppelin, of course, a lot of the English bands, we had a different way of approaching things. We weren't so laid back and relaxed. And that's what I found the difference to be. Very much. It's a different kind of music. I mean, I lived in Nashville for 16 years, and I worked that mostly as a songwriter, but I engineered a lot of demos for publishing companies, a lot of artists with 18 session musicians and a lot of demo singers that went on to become big stars. And the way they worked, they were so in the right pocket, you know. They were like, what, two clicks behind, whereas the UK, we were two clicks ahead of the beat. You know, we were, well, we had to do it where they were sitting back on it. And it's very difficult to mix the two, you know, just to get that feel. That was kind of the difference between the American musicians and the British musicians. I think when the heavy rock thing came in, and I produced, I think, three albums with UFO as a classic thing, that kind of heavy rock or whatever you want to call it, when that was translated into the American thing, the American thing, people were playing that heavy rock, but they were still sitting back on the beat. The drummer would sit back on the beat on it too. So you could tell this is an American band. And, you know, a lot of English bands wanted to get that American feel and didn't quite get it. And I guess a lot of American bands wanted to get the English feel and didn't quite get it. So it's interesting. It's just the way you grow up. It's weird. It's not quite like brought up on reggae and you can play that groove, you know, like falling off a log, but it's a similar thing, developing that difference in a way the feel of a song is just by dropping a bit behind the beat. I mean, when digital came in, I have done I've recorded a band and I've dropped it back two clicks behind the beat. It's still on the one, but it's just slightly behind the one. I used to say it's like the drummer sliding on his seat rather than on top of it. But I kind of like doing that.
Well, since you mentioned UFO, I want to... Phenomenon is one of my all-time favorite albums that you produced. I believe that's the first one with Michael Schenker. I heard that when I was 6 years old. I'm going to be 53 this year, and I don't think I've ever lived without a copy of it.
Your mother let you listen to it when you were six.
I had an older brother, and he used to let me go in his room. And I think if my mom had heard that record, you know, some of the things she might have. But I love that album, and one of the things I love about it is some of what we've been talking about, which is that you captured the feel of that band at that time. It's not too tight. It's not too loose. And it's, a good representation of what they were.
It is, yeah. I think, you know, I've always tried to bring out the best in a band rather than tell the band exactly what to do. Some people, it's like the engineer that puts all the EQ on the kit before he hears it. A lot of producers say, well, you got to do this, you got to do this. I tried to go to a rehearsal and we'd routine the songs and... I'd make some suggestions, need a chorus there, needs another verse, that kind of suggestion. But then my job was to get the best out of him in the studio and by whatever means was at my disposal, you know. And that's what we did. And, of course, you had to take into account budgets. You know, when you're recording a band that nobody really believes in, which was how it was with the UFO at the time, they give you a pitiful amount of money on a budget, so you've got to work. You know, I think with that phenomenon, I think my goal was three tracks a day, three backing tracks a day, then time for the vocals, time for the guitar, time to pick up, you know, maybe add a keyboard, I think, or anything like that, and then mix it. So, you know, you've got, I think it was about, the budget on that was £1,500, about the same in dollars now, but... And that was including mixing and, you know, the whole bit. So we had to work to the bigger the money, the bigger the drum sound. You know, I always say, I've worked on records. I've played on records as well, other people's records. I worked with on a Leslie West record, and he'd asked me to produce it, which I started to, and then I thought, no, I don't want to do this, but. Oh, we're not going to do anything today to record today. We're just going to get the drum sound. And I said to the guy, and I was the producer at the time, I said, well, you're the studio engineer. That's the studio kit. I mean, you already got a drum sound. You know, the whole thing changes, but that's the way it is. I like to work as quickly as possible.
That record, I think, also has really strong material. So it probably helps when you've got a band that's got, they come in and they've got good songs.
Yes. But you know the interesting thing, the way I worked with UFO, and I think on all three records, and the way I assume George Martin, who I knew, after I finished with them, they George Martin did a record, so I knew it was the same with him. Phil Mogg is a brilliant singer, and I like his lyrics, and this and the other. But he never has the songs finished when we start recording. So I'm imagining what the vocals is going to be and listening to, we're recording the backing track. an instrumental backing track, and then the vocals he's got that comes in at the last minute with the vocals. So it's a you never know what you've got until the day the vocals go on, because you know it's a song, it's somebody singing, isn't it? Great guitar playing, great groove, great playing, exciting, but I really want to hear what the vocals are going to do. And that was tricky. And the same thing happened to George. I kept saying to Phil, when are we going to do the vocals? I'll come. Well, Phil left it till the last moment that they got so embarrassed by it. They left. They were out in Montserrat. They left and left George there with the unfinished tracks. It was, one of those legendary UFO stories. But I got on well with them. I enjoyed working with them. I did a Wasted album as well with Pete Way and on top of that. But they decided they wanted it. I think the record company decided they should use an American producer because they needed to get into the American things. And, you know, people say to you, and when I started out producing and a producer, very successful producer, he did Manfred Mann, I believe, and lots of bands. And he part-owned Air Studios with George Martin and John Burgess, his name was. And John started recording less, but managing. And he managed George Martin, and then he decided he would manage me for a time, which he did. And he said, treat every album like your last, Leo, and every musician like an asshole. And I thought, that's really a bit too much. But I mean, what I could say is, if anything goes wrong with the recording, it's not the A&R man that signed them, it's the producer. You know, it's not the material, it's the producer that signed them. So you have to be prepared to stick your neck out if you feel something's wrong, and you have to put up with whatever people tell you. But it's a tough old job. It's when it's going well, it's absolutely fantastic. When it's not going so well, you really would like to go home. But we didn't have that. We didn't have that with on any of the UFO problems, records problems. Didn't have any problems on UFO records.
I want to ask one last question about Shush, and that's if my understanding is correct, this would have come out. The album would have come out roughly one month after you played Woodstock.
It would have done, but it would maybe have been released in other territories before the States.
Okay.
And it certainly would have been recorded before we played Woodstock.
Oh, surely.
I mean, the way it worked, in those days, you do like maybe three 7-week tours of America, three albums, tours in Europe, all over Europe. And hopefully you'd have a bit of time off to go home. But it was very intense. So everything was rolling like a snowball down a hill, you know, it was gathering momentum. And you'd just be finishing an 8-week tour, and then you'd get a phone call saying, oh, we've just put a gig at the end of the tour in Nova Scotia or something like that. And off you'd have to go. Maybe it was some mafia connection that decided he wanted to book the band and nobody could say no. But it was fun. I enjoyed it. I was single right up until almost the very end of the 10 years after career. So it didn't matter to me. But some of the guys had girlfriends and one thing and another and wanted to get home. But I was quite happy on the road, which is why I lasted it for longer than Alvin. Alvin, it got too much for him. The bigger we came, the less he enjoyed it. And before Space and Time, we took a year off, and Alvin told our manager, we're too big. We're way too big. De-escalate our career. We need to be playing to smaller people, smaller numbers of people. So, it was a strange thing. All the people that, obviously the people that the record label and everybody that invested in it were not happy. But Then we brought out Space and Time, and we had that hit, I'd Have to Change the World, and it became gold and platinum or whatever it became. So it was there. It was a whirlwind, you know.
The Woodstock performance would have, for instance, boosted this record then ultimately.
It certainly did. That was the first record we had on Columbia Records. And I saw one of the faxes that Clive Davis sent it to the promotion guys saying, this record will go gold. You know, it was, or you'll be looking for a job probably. But yes, we were building up. We were building up from our first tour of America. That Bill Graham had heard our first record and invited us over, and we went over there on the Wing and the Prayer with I think three or four confirmed shows and 6 weeks to do it on borrowed money. And that opened it up for us. And that by the time we got to prior to Woodstock, Shush was the fourth record. It hadn't quite come out then, and we were playing to, I guess, 4,000 people a night. So it was, you know, it was starting to happen for us. But Woodstock escalated it, and it escalated it all over the world in a way. And it meant that, you know, you could play some college campus in the middle of nowhere that had a 10,000 capacity auditorium on a Tuesday night and do two shows. You know, it changed it quite drastically. I mean, a lot of the time in the early days, we'd do three nights at the Fillmore's, or two or three nights in Boston, or, you know, something like that. And a lot of college gigs, and then Woodstock just—it was in the words of Spinal Tap, we were in the Enormodromes, you know.
Wow. So, well, you said something about six confirmed dates, and I'm wondering if you had this experience. So I've heard like the guys in Judas Priest talk about how early on they would come over, they'd have, you know, 10 days opening for somebody, and then they'd sit in San Francisco for 4 days waiting to find out what tour they were going on next.
Yeah, well, it wasn't quite like that, because we had work anyway in Europe. We were starting to happen. But we went over to do the Fillmore's, and we did the New York and San Francisco, and then we did Boston, and we did Huntington Beach, and we did, what's that, Whiskey a Go-Go.
Okay,
and maybe two or three other shows. Oh, Arizona, Phoenix with Grateful Dead. I remember that, but that was over a period of being there for maybe 5 weeks. You know, subsequent tours. When I say we do a 7 week tour, that's 7 days a week. On a 7 week tour, you'd have maybe one day off, and it would always be, I don't know. No disrespects to Cleveland, but it would be Cleveland rather than Hawaii. You know, it would always be sitting in a hotel room where it was pouring down with rain, thinking, oh God, why aren't I home, you know? But and I'm sure Cleveland's lovely. I just picked that one out, but it was never the place where, wow, this is going to be it. So it was tough. It was every day a different gig. And if you did two or three days in the same place, that was the rest for you, you know?
Wow.
And that went right the way on, right through 10 years after career, before we stopped touring, you know? And then when we got back together again and did an American tour, we did the same thing, but this time on a bus. But in those days, we flew everywhere. I'd rather have gone by bus, but the other guys didn't want to do that for whatever reason. They didn't have to have a reason. They just decided they didn't want to do that. Maybe I said I'd like to do it, and they all said, no, we don't. Funny. It's like working with, being married to four women at the same time, or three women at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
You can't please everybody. It's and 7 weeks stuck together. You know, it's tough. It gets tough on for everybody.
I see you've got your instruments behind you.
Yeah. I don't have a
Are you
I don't have a studio now. I mean, I work mostly on computer, and a lot of the time people send me stuff, and I record it. I record whatever I want here, whether it's a guitar or vocals or whatever, and mix it, send it back, and they send it back, and I mix it here. So
still writing and
yeah, well, the writing thing's different. I mean, I went to America, maybe, God, time flies, doesn't it? I lived there 16 years, so maybe 20, could be 26 years ago, couldn't it? Oh my God. Yeah. But no, 1998, 97, as a staff producer. So then I was writing, I had to write, and I went into an office and wrote every day, or co-wrote every day. You had to turn in 26 acceptable songs, which means the publisher decided if that was the one, or yet they had to write more. So I did that. And then the business in Nashville has changed. You know, the way the record business has changed. Now everything's so difficult to make money, other than touring. Your touring is the best way to make money now for most artists, but the record company wanted artists that wrote their own songs, and if they couldn't write their own songs, they needed a writer to write with them. So unless you were writing with an artist that had got a record deal, you'd be very lucky to get a cut. And so the number of professional writers, staff writers, in other words, writers that got paid a writer's draw each month, he got paid a small amount of money, subsistence money. And then when you had a cut, you made money then. But that went down. I don't know, 50% of writers there now to what they were when I was there. So I got to the point where I only write if there's a project to write. So I've had my own band called 170 Split. We've done six records. So I wrote for all those. When we needed a record, I wrote for those. But I don't write a song. I've got a lot of unfinished songs and a lot of songs that haven't been cut. But I don't kind of write on a daily basis thinking, oh yeah, this is a great song, because I can say it myself, can't I? I've got some songs that I think are good, but nobody's recorded them. Why should I write some more songs unless it's for fun? So I write for fun. And I doodle, I've got notebooks. I'm not going to show you where they are because I don't know where they are. We're in the process of moving, but where I've got unfinished songs. So if I got together with someone and we're doing a project and we're looking for something, I can pull something out and we'll finish it and we'll record it, and maybe somebody will like it, maybe someone won't. It's difficult to tell. But it was an interesting period in my life being a staff writer in Nashville, because I think some of the greatest writers are there, and the greatest musicians and the greatest singers are there. And to me, that was an inspiring, an inspirational place to be. We had a house there. I sold that, and when we moved back here, but it was very inspirational. Alvin said to me, "Why are you going to Nashville? All the best players are there." And I said, "Well, that's why I'm going there, man. I don't see it as competition. I see it as the chance to learn something." And I did. And I've always liked country music too. So that's what I did. And there have been times when I've produced records. There have been times when I've written songs. Sometimes I've played on people's records. Sometimes I play in had my own band and put that out, and then I go back to doing, what would you say, bugger all for a period of time. I write, I'm in the process. For the past, from the age of 25, I was writing my biography, and I kept writing it and then stopped writing it. Occasionally I'd pitch it to someone and they'd say, "Well, yeah, when the last one I got, I wrote this." And, well, it'd be good if you made it into a novel. And I thought, actually, it's the whole point of my biography is not, I was 10 years after and we played Woodstock and we did this. It was really about the thrill of growing up in the 50s, and the inspiration and the music and all the things that were happening. And then, having the privilege to, I don't know, to see Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Elvis Presley, you know, play with all my contemporaries, you know, with Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Tall with the Eagles and absolutely, and the Grateful Dead, of course, and all that. And just the luck, you know, I've said many times, I was felt like the Forrest Gump of rock and roll. You know, I was in swinging London, you know, what it used to be called when that happened. I was in Hamburg at the time of the Beatles. I was in San Francisco where, towards the end of the, you know, the flower power thing. And I was right there in the middle of it when all this psychedelic stuff and the second English invasion happened. And it's gone like that. And I've pretty much been all over the world. So that was what the excitement that I wanted to get over to people in my book. I didn't want it to be, when we played the Forum in LA and we had 22,000 people, and the next time we played, we did two nights and then we had 25,000 people. Not all that. It was just the thrill of it. Because the thing is, there's a lot of guys that play music, and when they come and see a band like 10 years after, or my band 170 Split, they stand there and they look at all the equipment you're using and they think, I could do that. You know, that's something I could do. And I'm doing it for them, you know. And I was just lucky. It could have been the next guy to me or whatever, you know. You happen to, by pure luck, be in the right place at the right time and something happens. But, you know, luck's something that you just keep going till you find that. I mean, it was 9 years before I started to earn a living doing it. But I just had a belief that that was what it was. And, you know, we were fortunate to make it happen. So, you know, that's where I'm at. I don't think I've retired, but I'm not sure whether I'm going to do any more gigs. It depends. Depends. My drummer died in my band and that last year. And that I decided I didn't want to tour this year, but I've penciled in some shows for next year and we'll carry on. It's never been about the money. That's just something, you know, fortunate to happen. It's a lot of young guys say they want to do it, but they don't want to travel around in the back of a U-Haul van, or, you know, they want a tour bus, or they want to fly, or they want this, and they don't want to take the girlfriends, or, you know, that's got to be a 5-star hotel, or the catering's not right, or there are no flowers in the dressing room, or it's the wrong brand of coffee, and, you know, all sorts of things. And, you know, that you can get all those stupid things, but if that's what you're doing it for, then you're going to have a really hard ride, I think. You've got to love what you do and believe in it, because it's 98%, 99%, you know, rejection. No, nobody will get that. Nobody likes that. Nobody wants that music. Why? You're killing the music business. You know, it's weird. That's what it is. It's a sad, sad, sad tale for people if they think they... I think a lot of people now don't want to be a musician. They want to be a rock star, you know, and that's the way they see it. And they can sit in the room and they can do it. You know, good luck. They can do a YouTube video and they can make more money than I've made in my entire life. But it's not real, because it doesn't give you... I don't know. It's a whole different way that things are these days.
You've been listening to a conversation with Leo Lyons all about the 1969 10 Years After album Shush, which has just been reissued by Chrysalis Records. You can learn more about 10 Years After at 10-years-after.co.uk and more about Leo Lyons, including his work with the band 170 Split, at leolyons.org. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And before we go, we need to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.